There's one thing that every person in this room and every person on our planet has in common. And that is that every single one of us who was born will one day die. There's numerous ways we fight this, with diet or exercise, prescription medication, things like this. But every single person who's been born into this world will die. There's nothing more certain than this, and at the same time, there's almost nothing more difficult and uncomfortable to talk about. You'd think that by this point in the history of humanity, we'd have figured out how to do this, but we really haven't. Death is difficult, and so is knowing how to lament. So is knowing how to put your grief into words. And it's something that we don't intuitively do very well. What do you say to a husband who's lost his wife? What do you say to a parent who's lost a child? Or to a child who's lost a parent? What do you say to someone who's lost their best friend? What do you say when someone dies in a tragedy? When someone dies in a way that is unexpected? When someone dies young, when someone's death is painful and drawn out? What do we say when we see and experience things in our world like school shootings? What do we say when we see in the news and media images of small children from Syria who have been gassed? It's hard to know how to lament. And the Bible has a lot to teach us about lamenting. And it does so not by giving us a list of propositions or a formula per se, but in so many ways and in so many places, the Bible models for us how to lament. And we're going to look at one of those lament songs this morning. And as we do, I want to just observe with you three different pieces that make up this lament. And of course, these pieces are not exhaustive to what every kind of lament is. But as we look at the different pieces of this particular lament, I think it's going to instruct us on how we should lament ourselves. So the first part of lament that we see in this text is very simply grief. David is grieving the loss of Saul. He's grieving the loss of his friend Jonathan. The text tells us David took up this lament concerning Saul and his son Jonathan, and he ordered that the people of Judah be taught this lament. So King Saul has died, and the throne is now open, and David is next in line to ascend to the throne. So the very first thing David does as king is he orders that God's people are taught how to lament and grieve. And he says, "A gazelle lies slain on your heights, Israel, how the mighty have fallen." As we look at David's grief in this first portion of this lament psalm, I'd like to just sort of poke at this from a couple different angles and see what we can draw out of here about David's grief. The first thing we see here is that David longs for the inescapable consequences of the death of Saul and Jonathan not to come about. He says, "Tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines be glad, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised rejoice." Now, the natural consequence of the Philistines coming into battle against the Israelite people and killing their king would be that they would go back to the cities of Gath and Ashkelon and the places they were from, and they would celebrate. There would be dancing and singing and celebration and probably a whole lot of drinking. And they would celebrate that they have killed King Saul. And David cannot stand the thought of this. He recoils at the thought of the Philistines rejoicing over the death of Saul. Not only this, we see the Philistines are delighting that they have successfully rebelled against God. And David is grieving this. As they have killed Saul, in a way, they are looking to not just Saul, but to the God that Saul worships, this Yahweh, this God of the Jews. They're looking at this God with contempt. They're scoffing at him. Because what kind of a God is this if he can't even, how powerful is your God if you get defeated like this in battle? And David can't stand the thought of this. You can hear echoes of Psalm chapter 2. Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth rise up and the rulers band together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their chains and throw off their shackles. David is grieving that the Philistines have, they're delighting in the fact that they have successfully rebelled against God. In addition to this, David can't stand the thought of things going on as if nothing had ever happened. He says in verse 21, mountains of Gilboa, which is where this battle took place, may you have neither dew nor rain, may no showers fall on your terraced fields. This is an agricultural picture that he's painting of the rain coming down and watering the terraced fields where they were the crops were planted. And he can't stand the thought of things just continuing to go on season after season after season as if nothing had ever happened. Now I think that we all have a sense of this kind of thing. Some of you sitting here in this room have lost a spouse. Some of you here have lost siblings. Some of you have lost children, parents. What would it do to you emotionally if 2 days after your sibling or your child or your spouse dies, you come home and their room, all of their stuff has been either dumped in the garbage and hauled away or taken to Savers, and their room is repainted, redecorated, and repurposed? That would tear you up inside. There's something that we hate about the world going on as if nothing ever happened. Some of you here have parents or grandparents who have gone into either assisted living or have died, and their homes have been sold, and has either been remodeled, maybe flipped, or gutted. And if you were to walk inside of that house today, you won't even recognize it. The kitchen table where you sat with grandpa and watched him eat his raisin bran, it's no longer there. The bedroom where you would go over and have a sleepover at grandma and grandpa's house is no longer there. Walls have been moved. The house is totally different. We hate the thought of things just going on as if nothing has ever happened. And this is what David is grieving. David is grieving also because he has the image of Saul in his mind as he's been killed in battle. For there the shield of the mighty was despised, the shield of Saul no longer rubbed with oil. Now in ancient times, shields were made of leather, and before you went into battle, you would rub the outside of it with oil, and this was a way of helping, it would better deflect arrows or rocks or things that you were trying to defend yourself from. And so David has this image in his mind of Saul and his friend Jonathan as they're going into battle and their shields are shining with this oil. And now the image in his mind is these shields that are dirty, splattered with the blood of Saul and Jonathan, strewn about on the ground among other weapons and among other dead bodies. There's sort of an irony that's in the text here. The shield of Saul no longer rubbed with oil. Another way to translate that would be unanointed with oil. So the irony is that Saul's unoiled or unanointed shield is laying in the dirt, and it's an image of Saul himself, who was the king that was unanointed by Samuel, and as he lays on the ground dead, finally rejected by God. David is grieving this. The second piece of lament that we see here is remembering. David not only grieves, but he remembers. He remembers the good that has been lost in both Saul and Jonathan. And anyone who's familiar with the story of Saul and Jonathan and David, it's sort of assumed that as we're reading 2 Samuel, that we would be familiar with what happened in 1 Samuel. And if we're familiar with what happened in 1 Samuel, we know that the relationship between Saul and David was not exactly pleasant. Saul was anointed as the king of Israel, and it was not long after that that he was rejected as the king of Israel by God. He was going into battle against an army that was larger in number and better equipped than their army was, and so he broke the law of God and offered a sacrifice to God. And this was something that the king was not allowed to do. And so because of this, Samuel comes to him and says, "Does the Lord delight in burnt offering and sacrifices as much as in obeying the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. For rebellion is like the sin of divination, and arrogance like the evil of idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king." So David is rejected as king, and then David is anointed as king. But David is anointed as king while Saul is still functioning as king. So you see how complex this is. Now, as far as we know, at least initially, Saul didn't have any idea that David was anointed as king. And from what we can see in the text, it appears as though the first encounter he has with David is when David comes and defeats this heavyweight champion, Goliath. And it's from this moment on that Saul begins to be terrified of David and angry at David and spends the rest of his life trying to kill him because he's winning the hearts and the affections of the people. David kills Goliath, and we're told that the women come out singing, "Saul has slain his thousands, but David his tens of thousands." And Saul is jealous. He's angry, and he hates David for this. And he literally spends the rest of his life trying to kill David. Now, we all have relationships that are a little bit uncomfortable, maybe. People in our life that you sort of just think, you know, I don't think I'd want to run into them at the grocery store or at the gym. Just uncomfortable, awkward relationships, or maybe you had kind of a falling out with them. But I don't suspect that many of us here have relationships with people that are spending years and probably decades of their life trying to kill you. David is living as a fugitive. He's always looking over his shoulder. He has to live every moment able to, at the drop of a hat, pick up everything he owns and move on to the next place. What an exhausting way to live. So here's the question. Does it seem even a little bit odd to you? Does it seem a little bit strange that David would even write this song of lament for Saul? Would you? David remembers Saul, he remembers Jonathan, and he celebrates what was lost. Now, of course, it's clear that what we have here in this song, this is not a balanced picture of Saul's life. But the things that David does say about Saul here are, number one, the things that he wants Saul to be remembered for, and number two, they are true. He says, from the blood of the slain, from the flesh of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back. The sword of Saul did not return unsatisfied. Saul and Jonathan, in life they were loved and admired, and in death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Saul was very successful as a military leader. And you can read the account of his successes. Not only this, David says, daughters of Israel, weep for Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and finery, who adorned your garments with ornaments of gold. In and through his military success, Saul did afford the people, at least pockets of people, some amount of prosperity and wealth based on his plunders of war. David remembers the good that has been lost in Saul and Jonathan, and he grieves what could have been. And it's right for him to do so. The last part of this lament is hope. We see grief, we see remembering, and we see hope. And this is what makes grieving as a follower of Jesus different than grieving as someone who is not a follower of Jesus. There's sort of a twist in the story at this point. So if you remember back to the very first line of the poem, a gazelle lies slain on your heights, Israel, how the mighty have fallen. Then in verse 25, how the mighty have fallen in battle, Jonathan lies slain on your heights. Do you see what's happening? What's happening here is that the height of David's lament here is not over Saul. It's over Jonathan. We get a small picture of their relationship. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of women. And of course, this passage has been misunderstood to be describing some sort of romantic relationship between the two of them. There's a lot I could say about that, but I will just say that way of thinking fails to understand the significance of friendship and covenant relationships in ancient culture. There's a subtle contrast that's being made throughout this song. Saul's life is characterized by unfaithfulness, jealousy, anger, bitterness, self-reliance, self-preservation. Jonathan, on the other hand, his life is characterized by covenant faithfulness, loyalty to God's king, loyalty to David, love for David. Jonathan was, as the son of the king, he was next in line. He was the heir to the throne. But he gave up the throne to David, and he did so willingly, and he gladly accepted David as his king. So Jonathan here is pointing us to David as the king that Saul failed to be. David is a far better king than Saul ever was in so many different ways. But even still, even David failed to be the king that God's people needed. So this whole narrative of this poem is lamenting, it's grieving Saul and Jonathan. But if we're looking at what the characters are trying to communicate to us, we see that Jonathan is pointing us towards David as the rightful king, as the one that we should be giving our allegiance to. But even David failed to be the king that God's people needed him to be. And so the question then is, well, where's the hope in that? The hope in that is that even in the failure of King David, God has not abandoned his people. As we're going to see over the next number of weeks, God made a covenant with David. And he established a kingdom for David. And in the opening words of Matthew's gospel, It was written to a Jewish audience who would have been steeped in these stories of David and Saul and Jonathan. The opening line is, "This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah," or the anointed one, the king, the son of David, the son of Abraham. So we get to the New Testament, and it's clear that Jesus is King David's greater son, and that through him, God has established a kingdom that cannot and will not ever be shaken. And of course, the way that he established this kingdom was totally unexpected. He didn't come as a king and channel his power into conquering his enemies through military force. But rather, the king of the universe came with humility and he served us. He laid down his life and he died for us in order to make us citizens of this new kingdom that can never be shaken. And he teaches us how to pray. Your kingdom come. When Jesus comes, he inaugurates the kingdom while he's here. And he promises that he will return to finally answer that prayer, that his kingdom would come on earth as it is in heaven. And so this is our hope. As we learn how to grieve and remember, we do not do so without the hope that is ours in Jesus. As we come to the table today, would you bow with me for a moment of prayer?